I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, our conversation on this Memorial Day, the rich history of America's cemeteries. But first, lawmakers are back in their districts as Americans remember and honor those who've died in war. When Congress returns to Washington next week, at the top of their agenda, honoring the living. The new GI Bill is called the 21st Century GI Bill of Rights, and its key provision is a retirement benefit of full tuition at a four-year state college or university, including living expenses and a book allowance, for anyone who served at least 3 years in the U.S. military since the attacks of September 11th. Both Senators Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton voted for it, but critics, including Senator John McCain, argue that the measure would hurt the military by encouraging experienced soldiers to retire. They want a compromise bill that would offer a retirement benefit of full education after 6 years, and as a lure, those benefits could be shared with a family. Well, with us is Paul Rykoff, Executive Director and Founder of Iraq and Afghanistan and Veterans of America. Paul, we understand you're for the three-year bill, which was passed by Congress and now is part of the larger war funding bill.
I am, and I think it's important to note, so is every other major veterans group in America. This bill's got the broadest support that I've seen in my 4 years of working on veterans issues, not only in Washington, but within the veterans community and across America.
Well, remind us, it's not a new concept. Remind us of the post-World War II GI Bill.
Yeah, after World War II, the GI Bill paid for the full cost of college. It paid for room, board, tuition, books, and it was really, I think, a key catalyst in help creating the middle class in America. About 8 million veterans got educated under the original GI Bill, and for every dollar invested, about $8 was returned to the national economy. So it's arguably the most successful government program in American history. And what we're trying to do now is get the current GI Bill, which is really just a shell of that old GI Bill, back on a war footing.
Well, what happened? Where did it go?
Well, we went to a peacetime military. And I think it really got hollowed out. Right now, the GI Bill only covers on average about $9,000 a year. There's a $1,200 buy-in up front that we call a combat tax. And it doesn't have equality for National Guardsmen and reservists. So it hasn't kept up with the wartime environment. It hasn't kept up with the incredible amount we've asked our National Guardsmen and reservists to do. And it hasn't kept up with the cost of college. So it's really become an outdated piece of legislation that needs immediate improvement.
Well, Paul, are you sympathetic, though, to the fears of the Pentagon and the White House, John McCain, that if there's incentive after 3 years for troops to leave and have a full college education, they will? And the troops are already stretched. There aren't enough to fight the battles in Iraq and Afghanistan. And the thinking on the part of critics of the bill is that this will actually do more harm to troops who are still serving if there aren't enough, of their comrades to go with them.
No, I'm really not sympathetic, because this argument being proposed by Senator McCain and others basically says that if you make the benefits too good, people are going to use them. And what we know is that educational benefits are the number one reason why people join the military to begin with.
So you think it's a good recruitment tool?
Absolutely. Any potential loss we'd see on the retention side would be dramatically offset by the benefit in recruiting. And I think it's also important to note that there's a philosophical divide here. The GI Bill was intended as a veteran's benefit, not as a retention tool. If we are so concerned about retention, then let's give everybody in the military a 25% pay increase across the board.
Well, as you know, people like John McCain are concerned. They say that one of the things you retain if you go with his plan, which is to extend the benefits after 6 years and also have the ability for a service person to share those benefits with a spouse, that if you do that, you create more experienced troops. And then if you let troops leave after 3 years, you're losing that crop of experience.
I think they're kind of swimming upstream here. The reality is that most folks who join the military don't join it for a career. We can try to come up with all these creative ways to lock them in forever, but the reality is that most folks don't want to be in the military for 20 years. They want to do some time, they want to serve their country, and then they want to get out and do other things. And those folks who only serve 2 or 3 years and maybe are wounded in Iraq and Afghanistan, are they not entitled to educational benefits like folks who fought in World War II or who fought in previous generations?
Two thoughts, Paul, from critics. The original GI Bill was for a draft army. This is a volunteer army. Some feel that benefits aren't as appropriate. And secondly, it was a different dollar. You know, when my dad got a GI Bill education and home, it was just a different economy. It's unaffordable now.
No, I really don't think that it's unaffordable. We're talking about less than $2 billion a year. The war cost more than that in about half a week.
And what about the thinking that offering benefits to people who've been drafted is one thing, but if you volunteered, you know what you're getting into?
I think wartime service is wartime service. And if we're going to have a volunteer military over time, we've got to figure out ways to make that sustainable. And I think the president's got a choice to make. If he decides to veto this bill, he's really voting against the best interests of a new generation of veterans.
Paul Rieckhoff, executive director and founder of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. And by the way, Paul, I wish you well on this Memorial Day.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
The peace and quiet of Mount Auburn Cemetery here in Massachusetts. Longfellow is buried there. So is Winslow Homer, amid towering sculptures and blooming azaleas. Across the street, the Cambridge City Cemetery. Driving by yesterday, I saw neat rows of flags standing at attention at the uniform gravesites of veterans. This holiday began in 1868 as a day to honor the Civil War dead. It grew to include all military losses, then became a day of reflection for everyone who's lost someone, and increasingly, a day for people who just appreciate cemeteries. Cultural historian Marilyn Yalom is one of them. With her photographer, Sun Reed, she's put together a fascinating new book, The American Resting Place, 400 Years of History Through Our Cemeteries and Burial Grounds. She joins us, and Marilyn, we understand the project began after you buried your mother close to you, as she requested. What happened in your little corner of the Alta Mesa Memorial Park in Palo Alto, California, where your mom is buried, that led you on this journey?
Well, my mother was buried almost 11 years ago, and over the years I came to notice how the cemetery is alive at different times of the year. Different peoples bring different offerings. Chinese people bring oranges at the Chinese New Year. Jewish people leave stones on the tombstones at the yearly anniversary of the person's death. So many different rituals, and that's what drew me in.
You also started to ask, who are these people sleeping here? You start to muse about the headstones. How was it that Moshe Verblonsky, his marker crowned with a Jewish star, came to take a Japanese wife named Noriel Sato? Or why was Gus Mozart's life encapsulated on his headstone with the image of a Volkswagen? You know, you got curious about the lives.
In fact, a little too curious for the Alta Mesa people, because they saw me snapping pictures and they really didn't want me there in such a present way. So instead of writing only about one cemetery, I drew in my photographer son and I said, let's go and look at some other cemeteries and begin to photograph on a grander scale.
There's a helmet on a cross at the Reservation Cemetery in Gunlock, Utah. This is for the Shivwit Band of the Paiute Indians. Look, here's a handwritten sign, so badly missed, and missed is spelled M-I-S-T-E-D, so badly misted, at the Holt Cemetery in New Orleans. It breaks your heart. What was happening to you as you started to do, as I do, flipping through those photos, see the range of ways that Americans commemorate their dead?
It gave me a whole new appreciation of this country as a country of immigrants. Successive waves of people coming from Europe and Africa and Asia and Latin America, each group carrying its own burial rituals. Burial is probably the most conservative aspect of any culture. Religions, different ethnicities hold on to those rituals probably longer than almost any of the other rituals. And so I think this was extremely moving for me to see this country in its complexity through its cemeteries.
Let's begin at the beginning, though, with the Native American burial mound. The dead buried above the ground, covered with dirt. But then, in many cases, other bodies added?
Yes. The first layer would get filled up, and then another layer would be added, and then sometimes a third or a fourth or a fifth. Some of those mounds rise up 40, 50 feet. The one pictured in our book is from Etowah, Georgia, and that's an idyllic community that seems to have remained exactly as it was in the 1600s when Hernando de Soto saw those mounds.
Well, let's move to the Puritans. They wanted to separate themselves from Anglicans and Catholics, very severe. No crosses, no no signs of divinity in their early burial grounds. Here in Boston, there's King's Chapel and the Granary Burial Ground.
It's true. They're very sober stones, but you do have death's heads.
A skull and crossbone kind of
thing? A skull with wings.
Ah.
And the skull represents mortality. The wings represent the possibility of salvation.
You step into these cemeteries and you're transported back to the 17th century, but they're very sober, not a lot of, you know, plants, very just, you know, lines of stones.
Well, that's, of course, the difference between the earliest inner city cemeteries. 200 years later, the 19th and 20th century cemeteries, which are rural garden cemeteries. And of course, the Boston area has the distinction of having the very first one at Mount Auburn in Cambridge. And that set the model for those beautiful garden cemeteries with trees and flowers and sculpture, which then began to proliferate throughout the United States.
The second one is Laurel Hill in Philadelphia. By the way, when did funeral gloves come into fashion, and what were they acted as sort of an invitation to a funeral?
If you received a pair of gloves, you were formally invited to the funeral, and sometimes the gloves were different according to your rank. You might get a more expensive pair if you were the governor of the state, and a less expensive pair if you were somebody's maiden aunt sister. Mm. So that was unique to early colonial America, and it died out in the mid-18th century.
Well, you write that things got so out of hand, one reverend had 3,000 pairs of funeral gloves and funeral gifts. People, families gave rings engraved with coffins. They were spending the estates of the deceased, so laws were actually passed to restrict spending. Before we take a break, you also saw the simple burial practice of the Amish. This is at the Amish Cemetery in Bird in Hand, Pennsylvania, where space is allotted for horses and wagons that still bring the coffins to be buried. The Amish still bury their own. You write, this place revealed to you the reasons you wrote the book. What were they?
The reasons have to do with why we bury people rather than simply expose them to the elements. There is something very soothing about the sight of cemetery stones grouped together as reminders of the people who have passed, as symbols of continuity with the dead. The Amish bury in the country and have a deep spiritual presence which is communicated to anyone who has the good fortune to walk inside such a sacred space.
And you saw so many of these sacred spaces. There's photographs of gypsies on their grave sites in Chicago, the San Fernando cemeteries in San Antonio, Texas. You saw so much joy, families holding picnics and parties on the Day of the Dead. Marilyn Yalom's book is The American Resting Place, 400 years of history through our cemeteries and burial grounds. When we come back, we'll look at southern cemeteries. Also later today, would you travel this summer if you got a gift certificate? We'll hear what tourist destinations are doing to get you into a car. Back in a minute, here and now. We're back with more from Stanford University scholar Marilyn Yalom. Her book is The American Resting Place, 400 Years of History Through Our Cemeteries and Burial Grounds, with photos by her son Reed. And by the way, that they're at our website, here-now.org. She traces the early burial grounds to the memorial parks, Forest Lawn in California, the first and most famous upright stones replaced by flat markers that allow sweeping lawn vistas, and some also sort of have a promise of an afterlife, too. There's a photo of Forest Lawn Cemetery in California, quite a contrast to the rural garden cemeteries, Marilyn, that we were speaking of. There are also photographs of cemeteries in the South, the tombs above the ground in the St. Louis Cemetery in New Orleans. There's a coffin-shaped tombstone at the Bethel United Methodist Church in Charleston, South Carolina. You say you saw a certain lushness in southern cemeteries. What else did you see?
There is also a richness in the epitaphs. One that I love in particular by a man in a black cemetery where he says, "Oh, Father, come close at my bedside. I am so tired staying here. I want you to take me home to live with you in heaven. I am going to fly with the angels. Goodbye, Mama. Goodbye."
Well, you mentioned black cemeteries. And what did you find? Did you find mass slave grave sites?
Slaves buried their own, and they didn't mark the graves in any permanent way. We did find the occasional stone that had been removed, say, in Savannah, Georgia. There is a cemetery that has a number of slave stones, one of which was marked with the name August, because slaves were often named after months of the year. One that we found in Missouri was surprising. The family buried their slaves in the same cemetery with them. The Jewell family cemetery had very, very fancy markers for their own. And then behind them, you see little stones. They're all not larger than the size of a brick, where the individual slaves were buried. And that was very rare.
I'm looking at another photograph from your son. This is the top of a headstone that's peeking out of a bank of snow. And you see that skull with the wings on it that you mentioned. And then underneath it says, Anne, a Negro child belonging to Mr. Robert Oliver. It begins to get covered by the snow. And that's in the common burial ground in Newport, Rhode Island.
Yes, you do find a section called God's Little Acre. And there you find blacks, slaves, and freed persons buried together. The thing about that particular stone is the euphemism, a Negro child rather than a slave child.
I'm looking quickly at the Oakland Cemetery in Atlanta. As you write, people trek there to see the grave of Margaret Mitchell, but also in the African American section, you see a gravestone in memory of Carrie Steele Logan, died November 3rd, 1900, aged 71 years, the mother of orphans. She hath done what she could. And then another marker for Anne Mary Webster. It just says, at rest.
Yes, that's a very interesting cemetery. It has groups for blacks. It has groups for Jews. It has groups for Confederate soldiers. And the Confederate dead are honored to this day in the South on Memorial Day.
Speaking of the military dead, of course, this is a day for many for that. Gettysburg, the first national cemetery, flat stone markers. As you sat there, you watched people do what, leave coins on the markers?
Yes, and people looking at the body count for each state. And it might say something like Wisconsin, 73 bodies, Indiana, 80 bodies, New York, 867 bodies. And I noticed one woman who said to another, look, we lost 171. She was from Michigan.
There are so many images. We can't touch on them all, but if you could just go through in your mind's eye just a few that we've left out that stay with you.
In California, going to the gold country and seeing those cemeteries that have been abandoned and have remained the same since the mid-19th century. Melancholy spots, people coming to the gold country with great promise and often dying within the first year of an epidemic or cholera or a woman in childbirth, or going even further, crossing the Pacific to Hawaii, seeing the Chinese cemeteries on Oahu, the Japanese stones that had fallen off of a cliff into the ocean on the island of Maui, and then continuing to the end of the road and arriving at the cemetery where Charles Lindbergh is buried, a flat stone with his name surrounded by painted white stones in the Hawaiian manner. Yes, there were so many.
I know, and we can't touch them all, and there are so many thoughts that you provoke in telling us about them. But one is, and we just want to ask about this, we mentioned the oldest rural cemeteries, Mount Auburn here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, Laurel Hill in Philadelphia. People love them. They take tours. They go there to birdwatch or to have some peace and quiet. But across the country, other cemeteries, well, in Troy, New York, Oakwood Cemetery stages a gourmet daffodil brunch. Hollywood Forever offers an outdoor film series with movies featuring the Hollywood stars that are buried there. Cemeteries have become places where people go to and where they go to for some of these, as you write, commercial enterprises. What do you make of that?
I don't have any personal negative feelings. There are about 250,000 cemeteries in this country, and there was a period where we really turned our backs on them. There has been great interest in restoring and preserving cemeteries, and you see it all over the place now, and that's a good thing.
And Marilyn, this book was born in your visits to your mom's grave. Are you going to be doing that this Memorial Day?
Yes, I will be doing that this Memorial Day. When I go there, I think of my mom. She was an inspiration in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Well, lucky you that it's so close and you can. Marilyn Yalom's book is The American Resting Place, 400 Years of History Through Our Cemeteries and Burial Grounds, photos taken by her son Reed. And remember, many of them will be at our website, here-now.org. Just a lovely book. Marilyn, thanks for speaking with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, an encyclopedia of Islam in the U.S. It's a bigger book than you might think. Also, Frank Sinatra back on Billboard's Top 10, out with his own stamp. Why is he so enduring? That's tomorrow. Still ahead, the view of gas prices from Marina in Kentucky. Pretty quiet out there. After the news, Here and Now. Memorial Day weekend marks the unofficial start of the summer travel season. It was thought that with the economy in the doldrums and gas hovering at the $4 a gallon mark, people would stay put. But the Boston Globe reports that at least here in New England, many hit the road anyway, enticed perhaps by beautiful weather. But what about this summer? Are you thinking of taking a staycation? That's a vacation near your home. If you are, you're not alone. The travel industry group TNS says that nearly a quarter of people surveyed said they've reduced their domestic travel plans this year, mostly because of gas prices. Leisure travelers are taking fewer trips and cutting back on expenses, although very few people are canceling all their holiday plans. As a result, there are lots of creative incentives out there. For instance, Cleveland, Ohio is offering tickets to see the touring production of Jersey Boys and the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Museum, along with a hotel stay. Joining us on the line is Suzanne Cook. She's the Senior Vice President of Research for the Travel Industry Association. First of all, Suzanne, that phrase, staycation, is that really catching on?
Yes, Robin, I've heard a lot. Of course, we don't like to hear that in the travel industry.
No.
And I think that, while certainly some people perhaps will opt to stay home, overall we expect that summer travel will hold up pretty well this summer. It may be off 1% to 2%.
Well, yeah, we have rushed to say that while a million people say, for instance, they're not going to travel on Memorial Day weekend, that still leaves 31 million people out there. You know, there's still going to be a lot of travel.
Yes, there will be. People will continue to travel. They don't want to give up that much valued vacation trip. It's really become kind of a mainstay of the American lifestyle. However, I think Americans will find ways to be able to afford that vacation trip. Prices are high, and people are very flexible in finding ways to do their trips.
Well, we spoke with Michael Mustafa, who's director of sales and marketing at the Westin South Coast Plaza in Costa Mesa, California. That's near Disneyland. He told us bookings are about the same as last year, and he is cautiously optimistic about this summer because of some special offers.
I think people are just being a little bit more selective on when they travel, where they travel. I think they're looking for value and value adds. We offer quite a bit of value-add packages, all of them via our website, and we have a fantastic weekend AAA package that is all-inclusive of your night stay plus three different dining experiences, as well as shopping at South Coast Plaza.
So we hear there from Costa Mesa, California. Suzanne, are you hearing the same thing, that hotels and businesses are giving incentives?
Most certainly. The industry across the board is finding ways to provide incentives, special deals, gas rebates, and the like to make it more affordable for people to travel.
States are doing the same thing. We're reading the Michigan Department of Natural Resources will store your trailer for free if you go there. We also spoke with Meryl Levitz. She's the president and CEO of the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation. They're offering hotel packages, one with a $50 American Express card. She said people in the industry aren't resting easy this summer.
With the economy, let's say, confusing to many people, with gas prices going up, people are not as ready for their summer vacation as they were last summer. But from what we can see so far, we think that demand for vacations and getaways will build during the summer because Americans consider it their right.
Suzanne, we're hearing that cities like Philadelphia have been appealing to their own constituents rather than advertising in other cities or abroad. Is that what you're hearing?
Yes. similar to trends we've seen before. In times like this, what happens is people tend to travel closer to home, so destinations can certainly appeal to people within a couple of hour radius. That's very beneficial, certainly, for major population centers like Philadelphia that you just mentioned. So I think this is a pattern we've seen before and not surprising in these times.
Well, if hotels and cities aren't your thing, you can always try skydiving, because Ed Scott of the U.S. Parachute Association told us that drop sites, as they're called, around the country are being encouraged to give deals two jumps for one.
You really don't have to go very far to have one of the most exciting breaks or vacations that you can experience. You know, strangely, our membership is increasing. That wasn't the case in the year prior to last year. We think people are going to be looking for things to do around closer to home, where they don't have to travel so much. I like to joke, you know, it's a short drive, and then you only go two more miles straight up in order to make your free fall, and then you're back where you started.
And cutting down on fuels as you go. I'm not sure I would use the phrase, you know, break with a parachute jump, but that's what they're giving, a break of two for one. And a jump costs about $200 on average, so that's a big deal. Just, Suzanne, what are some of the other deals that you've heard of?
Well, I think a lot of them focus on the gas price incentives. You know, there are rebate cards that many of the hotel chains are offering. If you stay at their hotel for a night or two, they'll offer you a $50 card. I think just the whole packaging concept of putting the hotel, the transportation, the activities all together. Certainly packaged travel is not anything new, but I think in times like this, when people are more sensitive to pricing, those become much more attractive.
That's Dr. Suzanne Cook, the Senior Vice President of Research for the Travel Industry Association. Suzanne, thanks.
All right. Thank you, Robin.
Well, Traverse City, Michigan is handing out $25 gas cards. We want to turn now to Kathy Russell. She owns and runs the White Swan Inn Bed and Breakfast, which, as her website notes, is just a few minutes' drive from the sugar sand beaches of Lake Michigan in Whitehall, Michigan. Kathy, what is your incentive to attract customers?
Well, I went with something a little bit different. Obviously, I'm still encouraging my guests to drive and offering them a $40 discount off of their two-night stay, but in turn, they have to bring me something as well. In exchange for that $40, I want them to bring me a grocery sack filled with either non-perishable food or personal care items that then I'm going to donate to our local food pantry. This way, everybody wins. I get a booking, the guest has a discount, and the local food pantry has a benefit for those people who obviously cannot travel anywhere.
Now, Kathy, this is a lovely thought from you, but I'm doing the math here. It might cost someone $40 to fill a bag with groceries of canceling out your incentive, but I'm wondering if you're appealing to people who actually would be incentivized by giving to someone else.
I think they would. I mean, I think there are a lot of people who have a very kind heart, and they are willing to do something a little bit beyond the average in terms of what they can give also. I don't think that bag of groceries is going to slow them down.
And how are you doing? How are your bookings?
Our bookings are okay for summer. The special has been up on a bed and breakfast website for a little bit, and all of a sudden it's starting to get attention. I think a lot of people were slow to book their things in Michigan right now because we've had a very cool spring, and it's just now starting to feel like summer might be coming.
Kathy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Kathy Russell owns the White Swan Inn Bed and Breakfast in Whitehall, Michigan. So, are you changing your plans? Have you come up with an innovative way to travel without using gas? Email us at here-now.org or call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. We are all ears. Before we go today, the two uniforms of Red Sox great Ted Williams. You're listening to Here and Now. So as we just heard, the rising price of gas has many resorts and businesses offering special deals to lure in tourists. but how to reel in boaters, especially when the price of a fill-up is hundreds of dollars. Regular unleaded gas is $3.93 a gallon nationally, and diesel, which larger boats use, is $4.65. It costs $700 to fill up a 40-foot boat with a 150-gallon diesel tank. And there's another problem. In many marinas, old pumps may have to shut down because they can't handle the new prices. Larry Helkamp is with the Southern Comfort Resort and Marina on Kentucky Lake in Kentucky. Larry, you went on TV there just before Memorial Day saying you would shut down if the price went over $4. Did it? And did you?
It did, and I did.
What'd it go to?
Our purchase price would be $401, which means that for us to be profitable in selling fuel, we'd have to go considerably above $4.
You have old pumps where have that little rotator wheel that rotates the price through. Doesn't dial up to $4?
Nope, sure doesn't. And ours were just updated last year to clear $3.
Well, I mean, it's amazing. We understand it's just a small percent nationwide, but that's about 17,000 pumps that can't handle this turnover. You know, did you ever think it would go to $4?
No. Completely blows my mind to think that something like that could happen. And, you know, realistically, we should have thought in advance and said, why, my goodness, $6 gas is possible.
What about getting new pumps, you know, that are computerized and could just keep going through the numbers?
For a small operator, that's just not price worthy. The idea here of buying another $3,000 distributor pump is just not realistic. Right. It's easier to close them down and shoo them on to the next big operator that can supply them gas.
Well, let's talk about the lake and the boaters, because you're having this problem with the pumps, but our understanding is that even if they were working, a lot of boaters aren't boating.
Well, that just is fuel for the fire and reason not to upgrade for me. We're down probably close to 70% in boat traffic here.
And do people tell you it's because of the cost of fuel?
Oh, sure, sure. I have a large marina, well, for us, 150-slip marina, and our people are sitting. They like to sit out there and talk and play cards and strum their banjos, but it's a different market for me. I'm not selling fuel. I'm selling slips.
Boat slips, which is where the people, you know, complain
about. Sure, they
about.
Gather. You know, somebody putting $700 in their fuel tank makes it a little prohibitive to just go cruising for the day with the in-laws and the kids, you know.
It gives us a real sympathy, too, for people who do this for a living, for the fishermen, but that's a separate topic. These are people, you know, out there for pleasure. And we're reading the same thing here in New England, that many people are treating their boat like a houseboat. Just keep it moored, invite people over, but don't pull anchor. Just sit there.
Sure. Then it's, you know, I'd do the same. The view is wonderful from our marina, and, you know, Kentucky Lake is a man-made lake that was topped off in 1945 by damming the Tennessee River, and when they topped it off, it backed up a body of water all the way to Knoxville. The lake here is 184 miles long. It's 2 miles wide, and across from my section of the lake is the land between the lakes. That's all primitive, so there's 3 to 6 miles wide and 40 miles long. And so we've got a little bit of everything over there, including sightings of Bigfoot.
Sounds beautiful.
If you like Bigfoot, it's marvelous.
What is lost? I mean, just tell us briefly, you might even be looking at that lake. What is lost when people don't get to go out on it?
An opportunity for fulfilling that fantasy that they've had all winter, I would say. Think of the things that drives us when we're sitting in the snow and thinking, boy, I just can't wait. I'm going out in the garage and polish my boat. When I get away on vacation, I can go cruising or I can go fishing or I can run across to the land between the lakes and camp. That just isn't happening now. There's a certain disillusionment that comes with the price of fuel. Camping is beginning to boom again. Since I have a campground, I'm delighted with that. It's a cruel adjustment that is beneficial to us.
Well, and some might say maybe beneficial to the environment. Larry, have you thought of putting out canoes?
Yeah, quite frankly, that and kayaks. Yes, we have.
That's Larry Helkamp of Southern Comfort Resort and Marina on Kentucky Lake in Benton, Kentucky. Larry, thanks so much for checking in with us, and best to you over the rest of the summer.
Well, and keep up the good work, kid.
Okay. When we come back, he was a legendary slugger and a marine aviator, Ted Williams. In 1 minute, here and now. Today, communities across the country took note of Memorial Day with parades and ceremonies to remember the servicemen and women who've died in all U.S. wars. Earlier today, President and Mrs. Bush laid a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknowns at Arlington National Cemetery. We also have this Memorial Day quick note about how the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are noted on other days. The Project for Excellence in Journalism reports that as of last week, coverage of the wars in broadcast and print media fell to 3%. Compare that to last September when the wars took up 23% of news coverage. Mark Jerkowich of the Project for Excellence in Journalism says that with the success of the troop surge, issues like the election and the economy have taken attention away from the conflicts. Well, we pledge in the weeks ahead to keep an eye on things like the war funding bill. And we thought we'd close today with a look back at a man who wore two uniforms.
Here's the pitch. Williams swings, and there's a long drive to deep right. That ball is gone, and it is gone. A home run for Ted Williams in his last time at bat in the major league.
That's the late announcer, Kurt Gowdy, as Red Sox slugger Ted Williams hit a home run in his final at-bat at Fenway Park in September of 1960. That's the Ted Williams that most people remember, the legendary hitter, the last man to bat 400 in a season, with 521 career home runs. But those numbers don't count the five seasons that Ted Williams didn't play professional baseball. Captain Ted Williams served in two wars, World War II and Korea, was a flight instructor, flew 39 combat missions, walked away from one nearly fatal plane crash, and was back in the cockpit the next day. Longtime Williams biographer Bill Nallen wrote about the military career of Williams in the book Ted Williams at War. Those of us who even briefly had the chance to meet and talk to Ted Williams know that your title is double entendre.
Yes, he was at war with certainly sports writers, newspaper folk, and he had a few stormy marriages.
Yeah.
There were people he did get along with, though. He never got in a fight with a major league umpire.
There you go.
Never once kicked out of a ball game.
Well, but as you write in your book, he could have avoided military service entirely. When he was drafted, he fought it because he was the sole supporter of his mother. He won that case and then enlisted.
He had also bought a 3-year annuity, and he had to keep the payments up, which he couldn't afford to do on a military salary. So he wanted to keep doing that so that his mother would be set for life. Mm-hmm. He also resisted the notion of other people telling him what to do.
So you can't draft me. I'm going to enlist.
Right. Basically, he made his point. He fought it. He did win, as you said. And then he toured the spring training sites and got a huge rounds of applause from the service people in the audience. Made his point, and then just one day, without even announcing it, except to one friend who covered it, he went in and signed up for the Navy.
Right. Now, put us in context at this time. Who is this Ted Williams who's first enlisting in the Navy?
At that point, he'd just finished the season in which he hit 406. That was 1941, and December 7th, Pearl Harbor. So just he hardly had time to enjoy it, and here he was, part of a whole country that was plunged into war.
He became a pilot in the Navy. Given his keen eyesight that also served him as a hitter, you know, that wasn't so surprising. Then he switched over to the Marine Corps, and that would be proved to be pivotal. As you write, he didn't serve in combat in World War II. He was a flight instructor. But he was called back into service for Korea April 1952. Now, this is a very different time in his life. Set the scene here. Who is Ted Williams at this point?
At this point, he was 34 years old. Or turning 34 that fall. He had set all kinds of marks as a public figure. He'd already won the batting title several times. He was perhaps the most widely photographed man in America.
The highest paid player in baseball. And he became, looking through your book, which is a beautiful book, it's styled beautifully, he had to be the most photographed Marine.
It's very interesting because he could have gone the morale-building route. He could have gone into special services and played ball, waved from platforms just to cheer the troops up and so forth. But he said no, he didn't want to go back. There's no question he didn't want to go back.
Did he think he was being exploited?
Yeah, he felt it was unfair. The Marine Corps had demobilized too many people after World War II. Had he been in the Navy Reserve, he would have not been called back. He believed that if he had not been such a public figure, they would have let him off one way or another.
Right. But, as you said, he decided to go the hard route.
Right. I wonder if he felt, having been in World War II but never seen combat, trained hundreds of other pilots to go fly, I wonder if he questioned his ability to measure up. what it would really be like. So he said, if I'm going, I want to fight. And so he became a dive bomber pilot flying Panther jets.
And saw a lot of combat. In fact, made a crash landing on his third mission, got out and got in another plane, went back up.
It was just about noontime that the plane crashed. At 8:08 the next morning, he was back on his base. Had to be ferried back, but he was up, just like getting back on a horse after you've been thrown.
The pictures throughout the book are fascinating. I mean, there he is serving with Johnny Pesky, but there he is with John Glenn, who later became an astronaut and senator. Ted Williams was wingman for John Glenn.
That's right. And John Glenn was extremely gracious to Ted, has been in some of his autobiographies. He said that Ted was his wingman for half the missions he flew in Korea, and he wouldn't have wanted anybody else to protect him on his wing. Mm. Well, that was somewhat of an exaggeration, but they did fly 8 missions together.
You know, I just had a moment of thinking what we would have lost. I mean, it's just a reminder that you never know who these soldiers, Marines, are going to become.
They both could have been shot down at the same time.
Right. You quote Glenn saying of Williams, he did a great job. He was a good pilot. Was he, in your estimation?
It's interesting. I talked to about 40 pilots that served with Ted in the 2 squadrons there and a couple of sister squadrons. Most of them agreed he was a good pilot, but not a great pilot. A couple people, I mean, he was a controversial guy, and even within the squadron, some people resented his fame and fortune.
He says, the two things I'm proudest of in my life is that I became a Marine pilot and that I became a member of baseball's Hall of Fame. I'm wondering how much the Marines is something that Ted Williams maybe really needed, someplace where at least someone would tell him what to do or tell him how to do it.
Well, as I mentioned before, he never got in a fight with a major league umpire. He also worked well in the hierarchy of the Marine Corps. He had commanding officers. He never had a serious disagreement with a commanding officer that popped out into and they had disagreements because he spoke up. And there was one guy that maybe recommended him for court-martial at one point, but kind of backed off.
Right. So it wasn't entirely submitting himself to, you know.
He spoke up, but he got along fine with people above him and below him. He was known, several of the enlisted men that I talked to said that he, as an officer, could buy alcohol and did. For some of them, he didn't drink himself.
Yeah. Do you think we'll ever again see a story like the Ted Williams story when it comes to his service in the military? I mean, we know that there is a parallel with former Arizona Cardinal Pat Tillman, who enlisted in the Army Rangers and was killed by friendly fire in Afghanistan, of course.
Well, the people that came to mind to me were Alex Rodriguez and Barry Bonds, because they're two huge figures in the ballgame today. And it's just inconceivable that either of them would suddenly become, you know, a helicopter pilot in Iraq. That's kind of the equivalent, because Ted was one of the, with Joe DiMaggio and a couple of other people, he was one of the 2 or 3 biggest figures in the game at the time.
What do you think the Marines did for him, and what do you think he did for the Marines?
Certainly he helped them. He was a poster boy for the Marines, and there were some rumors that he'd cut a deal at the end of World War II that we won't call you back if you let us use you for publicity. Well, that may have been forgotten at some point along the way. But I think the Marine Corps did a great deal for him. And I, many times at the Ted Williams Museum annual events, his last 10 years or so, when the band would come in playing the Marine Corps hymn, he would struggle to stand up. He'd had a couple of strokes, and you could just see the pride in him.
That's Bill Nowlin. His book is Ted Williams at War. Bill writes about other Red Sox players who served in the military in his upcoming book, Red Sox Threads, Odds and Ends from Red Sox History. It's due out in July. And just a quick nod on this Memorial Day to another Marine. My dad had a baseball signed to him by Ted Williams. It was one of his proudest possessions. Now it's one of mine. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Enjoy this day, and please join us again here and now. We'll be right back.